presence of men like Dr. Staley, Dr. Binkley, Dr. Copeland, the other outstanding men of the faculty of the seminary here, I'm almost inevitably reminded of one of my favorite stories that some of you have heard me tell at Ridgecrest. Dr. Merton Rice was one day talking to one of his good friends, Bishop Quayle, and he said, "Bishop, how do you manage to keep your spiritual vitality at such a high peak all the time?" Well, the bishop said, "I do what every other Christian does. I say my prayers, I read my Bible, I go to church." He said, "Of course, there are special things that help me. One of the things I like to do, for example, is to walk in the rain. I like to throw back my face and let the rain fall in my face, and I get a revelation." Sometime later, the two men met again, and Merton Rice said to the bishop, "You and your ideas." He said, "It rained the other day, and I remembered what you said, so I went out and walked in the rain. I threw back my face, I let the rain fall in my face, and the water ran down my neck." That I didn't get any revelation, I felt like a fool. "Well," said the bishop, "what more of a revelation do you want the first time than that?" And I do get a revelation of my inadequacy as I try to stand in the presence of such leaders. And yet, I hope out of my own experience, I will have something to share with you that may be helpful. When I was a minister in Richmond, Virginia, one day some girls who attended our church from West Hampton College asked if they could see me. They said, "We have a problem." They went on to explain that after class hours, frequently in the dormitories, they would get together in one room or another for what they then called Ferdinand sessions. Now I think they call them buzz sessions, which is a little bit more dignified. Now they said, "When we do, we talk about our studies, we talk about our teachers, we talk about our dates." And they said, "You would be surprised how often we talk about religion." Now they said, "Our problem is there is a girl in our dormitory this year who is a very fine girl. We don't find any fault with her moral ideals, but she is not a Christian. She's a very intelligent, very intellectual girl. And she asks us questions to which we're not sure we entirely know the answer. For while we are Christians and in a general sort of way know what we ought to believe, we've never thought our way through far enough to be articulate about it." They said, "Would you help us to know what books to read and what subjects to discuss so we can be more intelligent in our answers to her?" And so that group came together on Friday evenings occasionally, and we would sit together and talk about what it means to be a Christian and what a Christian ought to believe. And I have a suspicion that what happened in the thinking of those girls in those little informal get-togethers was one of the most important things that happened in their experience during that year. I wonder if there are not a lot of people in our Baptist churches in the same boat. There are people, of course, who belong to liturgical churches where they learn a catechism, and so they assume because they know the answers taught in the catechism that therefore they know all there is to know about religion. And this does not necessarily follow. I have talked to people who knew the answers in terms of being able to rattle them off, but when you got them away from their stated formulae and tried to make them put it in their own words, they were simply at a loss. They had never thought it through to where it meant something in their own personal experience. Now, in most Baptist churches, we do not have such a thing as a catechism. We simply say to the people, "The Bible is our authority and the New Testament is our creed. Read those and you will know what to believe, but the New Testament is a big book." And most people need a little bit of help in trying to understand at least parts of it. So then I wonder if, as ministers, we do not need to help our people think through a little more carefully what we ought to believe and can believe and why we should believe it as Christians, so they too can be more articulate when they talk about their faith and when they think about it. And so, reminding ourselves that Peter says, be ready always to give a reason for the hope that is in you to every man that asketh of you a reason. Tonight, I'd like to share with you what, to me, are the basic convictions of my Christian life. Now, you won't make the mistake of believing that I'm going to tell you everything I believe in 20 minutes. Obviously, that will be impossible. I'm not going to state it the way you would state it in many instances. I do not offer this as a creed in any sense. What I hope I will do is to stimulate you to think, what are the basic convictions of your Christian life? The things by which you live, the things that will hold you steady when the storms of life begin to blow. Peter Marshall once told me he couldn't preach until he saw a picture. And I see the value of that technique, and so tonight I'd like to give you the picture of a tent. You remember that Isaiah said that after the exile, Israel would be larger than before, therefore it would need a bigger tent. And carrying out the idea, he said, lengthen the cords and strengthen the stakes. Now, in the tent of religion, I know that the pole that holds it upright is our faith. Without faith, there wouldn't be any religion. But just as we need the poles of faith, we also need the convictions as stakes that can hold our tent steady when the gales begin to blow. Now, what are the stakes? You would drive deeply on the basis of your understanding of the teachings of the Scriptures. Let me tell you what I think they are for me. The first stake that I would drive and that has been driven deeply into my own consciousness and life is my belief that God is love. Now, I can imagine some of you say, wait a minute, don't you need to start back of that and say God is? For after all, the author of Hebrews says, he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is the rewarder of them that diligently seek him. And in a world where communists advocate atheism as a national and even international policy, where young people are often confused by some scientific teaching, we need to know why we believe God exists, if we believe it. Now, I think I know something about the philosophical arguments for the existence of God, ontology, cosmology, teleology. Basically, I believe in God because I've seen what happens in the lives of people when they have lived in terms of a high faith in God, and I have seen what happens in the life of people when they live as if there were no God. All I would have to do is to watch the Nazis and the communists and see what happens in their thinking and in their living when they reject the kind of a God in whom I believe, to know, to believe that I have firm conviction for believing that God is. And I know what happens in my own life when I feel close to him. And I know the unhappiness that comes when I feel I am not obeying his will as fully as I should. But the important thing is, what is he like? And I believe he's love. Why do I believe it? I believe it most of all because Jesus said so. That's all the proof, really, I would need, because when I want to know about God, I'll go to the one who knew most about him. I'll go to Jesus every time. And Jesus said, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. It took me a little while in my Christian life to come to an understanding of that verse, and I'm going to share that with you one morning in our chapel talks. Even yet, I can go into my son's room when he's home from college and look at that big, tall, lanky thing asleep on his cot, wondering if we gave him too many vitamins when he was a child. He wears a 13 and a half shoe, 6 feet two. And you know, I can still get a lump in my throat as I realize how much he means to me. And I say to myself, I could understand it if my Bible said God so loved his son he was willing to give him anything in the world, but my Bible says something infinitely more wonderful than that. It says God so loved the world, that's us, that he was even willing to give his son for our redemption. But Jesus not only said it, he lived it. And living on that basis, his life became the most winsome and the most spiritually compelling life that ever lived. But he not only lived it, he died to reveal it. I was once asked by some young people which I thought was the most important, Jesus' life or his death. And I said, that's like asking which is the most important side of a coin, the one side or the other. You can't separate them. They go together. Without his life, his death would have no meaning, but without his death, his life would have no saving power. By his life, he becomes my supreme example, but when I try to measure up to him, I know I never can be as good as he. I never can love as he loved. I never can be perfect as he was perfect. To try to go out and live like Jesus lived is to try to go out and invent like Edison. It's to try to go out and compose like Beethoven. I just can't. And if all I have is a perfect example, that's a despair. But by his death, he became my Savior. And as I see perfect love on a cross, I look through the cross into the heart of God and I say, God is like that. Because Jesus said it and lived it and died it to prove it. And everywhere I see it, incorporated in human living, even on a small scale, the results are such. I'm persuaded that God is love. Now here's my next stake. I believe that love operates in a moral universe, which of course is just another way of saying, be not deceived, God is not mocked, whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. You say, doesn't that cancel out this? No. This is the only kind of a universe in which love would know how to operate, the only kind of a world in which we would know how to depend on love. When I met my wife, she lived a mile high, so that it was quite a come down for her to marry me. Because I went to a pastorate in Philadelphia, which was at sea level. Now, my wife was a very excellent cook. She could make cakes that you almost had to keep your hand on to keep floating in the air. But when she came to Philadelphia and tried to make these same cakes, they went flat. Well, I told her that I knew I'd have an effect on her, but I wasn't sure that that was the kind of effect I wanted, and she couldn't understand it until all of a sudden it dawned on her one day. And then she discovered she had to learn to cook all over again. So that Fanny Farmer was almost as much read as the Bible. She had to use a different amount of sugar, a different amount of shortening in everything she made because she had come down so many hundred feet in elevation. And I remember one day as she was getting used to cooking at sea level, I said to her, well, fire burns at sea level just as it does out in the Rocky Mountains. And then I got thinking, suppose you never knew when fire was going to burn and when it wasn't. You'd never know on that basis what attitude to take toward fire. You'd never know when you were going to have a cooked meal or when you weren't. Suppose this week it burned on Monday, but it didn't burn on Tuesday. And then again it burned on Wednesday. Next week maybe it was Tuesday and Thursday when it... Well, you'd get all mixed up. But there's one thing we know about fire. Wherever we find it, fire burns, because that's the nature of fire. And so we teach the child not to play with fire. We kiss the tears away when the child gets burned, but we can't change the nature of fire. And God has told us over and over again that the nature of sin is to destroy. It is death. He can kiss the tears away after we get burned. He can tell us not to play with it, but the nature of sin is still what it always was. The wages of sin is death. Now, I think God puts us in this moral universe where we have to decide between right and wrong, between obedience and rejection, because he knows that's the only way character can grow. That's the only way love would mean anything. Marguerite Rowe tells about a little boy that had a pet kitten. Everywhere he went, the kitten would follow him around the farmyard. There was a little stream that went through the farm, and one day he and his father got in a little boat, and they were going to just take a little ride up this little stream when the kitten tried to get into the boat. But the boat was moving so rapidly that by the time the kitten got its front paws on the boat was gone and the kitten fell in the water. Quick as a flash, the boy grabbed the kitten, put it in the canoe, and then looked at his father and said, "Daddy, I'll bet that kitten thinks I'm God." And he began to stroke the wet kitten and say, "Kitty, God isn't going to let you drown." Well, the parents noticed that after that, for several days, every time he spoke to the kitten, he referred to himself as God. He'd say, "Here, kitty, God brought you some milk." They talked about it, wondering what they should do, and decided not to do anything for a little while. They said, "Maybe God will never be more real to him than when he thinks he's taking the role of God." Besides, they'd learned the way to raise a family and keep calm is to hang a sign in the nursery saying, "This stage will pass." Trouble is, it's always followed by another stage. One day they noticed that the child was trying to put the kitten in a box. He'd put the kitten in the box, it would jump out. He'd put it in the box, it would jump out. He'd put it in the box, it would jump out. And finally he lost his patience, and they were amused at hearing him say, "Now look here, kitty, not even God can make you stay in that box unless you put your mind to it too." And not even God can save us unless we want him to. Now, what happens in this moral universe when we reject the love of God, when we reject his will, when we set ourselves up as God? What happens when we sin? Inevitably, there is the chasm. When I look at man and look at God, I see this abysmal chasm between, caused by man's ignorance and man's sin. How can we bridge the chasm? The mind of man is a pretty wonderful thing, and by our thinking, by our reasoning, we try to reach out toward God. We try to put two and two together to see what the answer is. We observe the universe. We try to decide what it tells us about the maker of this universe. But even when we put our best brains to it, we are so finite, he is so infinite, that we're like a man hanging on one bank to a bush, reaching out across a river, not being able to reach the other side. And when we think of our sin, and we know how sin alienates us even from people in this world, so that it is a broken relationship, we realize what a broken relationship sin creates between God and man. Here's my third stake. Christ is God's bridge from God to man, over which by faith we can walk into a restored relationship with him. What we couldn't do for ourselves, God has done for us. What we could never know about God with our own reason, he's told us in Jesus Christ. The love that we could never earn with our own merit, because we never can be good enough, he's given us freely in Jesus Christ. What we couldn't do with our wisdom, because we're not wise enough. What we could not do with our goodness, because we're not good enough, God has done for us. The bridge is there. It's the cross, the incarnation. And when I see the goodness of God reaching out to me in Jesus Christ, knowing that I can put my trust in him and answer him and come back into a restored relationship, that's my third stake. When I was in Korea, I said to the boys, "If you'll give me the names of your parents, when I get back to the States, I'll write them a letter. I think they'll be glad to know I saw you, that you were in good health, and that I met you in church. They'll be glad to know you've been coming to church in Korea." And I came back with a briefcase full of names and addresses, and I wrote letters to all those parents, and loved ones, I got some of the most beautiful letters I ever received in my life. So many of them said, if you're ever in this part of the world, do come by to see us. And three of them said it in almost identical words. You'll always be welcome in our home because you met our son. And when I think how I stand condemned before the righteousness of God, I who am so unrighteous, then I hear him say, you'll always be welcome in my presence because you know my son. And so he becomes my advocate. I dare not walk into the presence of God alone, but by standing by him, I know that I can walk into the presence of the God of this universe with confidence. For he has commended his love toward me in that while I was yet a sinner, Christ died for me. Now, I think it's important to believe that, because here's my fourth stake. I believe man is an immortal spirit. One day this body will die. I don't know what the spiritual body will be like. I've got some changes to suggest to the Lord where I think he could make an improvement on this one. But I believe that when this body dies, that isn't going to be the end of me. We ran a church door canteen in our church in Washington during the war. We have the signatures of over 50,000 young people who came there for Christian fellowship, and many of them would come back on Sunday. And one young man came in one night into my study as I was seated there. He said, Mr. Cranford, I want to tell you how much this church has meant to me. He said, I never really went to church until I came here. But he said, I got coming to the church door canteen, and then somebody brought me to church, and I found myself coming Sunday by Sunday. He said, Christ never has meant so much to me. He said, I haven't got it all straightened out yet. For instance, he said, I'm being shipped out in a few weeks, and I don't think I'd mind going quite so much if I could really be sure if I didn't come back, that wouldn't be the end of me. Well, I said, son, I hope you do come back. But even if you didn't, I don't believe that would be the end of you. I said, science tells me that if I were to take some wood off my desk and burn it or dissolve it in acid, that I wouldn't destroy the molecules that are in that wood. I'd simply change their form. That all of the atoms that are in that wood right now, the energy that is there, would still be in the universe in another form. Do you believe what science says, that energy can't be destroyed, it can only be changed? He said, well, I guess so. Well, I said, I believe it. I think science says it almost dogmatically. Now, in this universe, as consistent as I think this is, if science says to me that energy can never be destroyed, it can be changed but not destroyed, I don't see why it's any more difficult to say that spirit can't be destroyed either. I asked him if he ever went up to hear the Budapest String Quartet. They use Stradivarius instruments. Priceless instruments. They're never taken out of the Library of Congress. When the concerts are over, they're put in a special vault where they're kept at a special temperature in special kind of gas. I said, can you imagine Stradivarius going to all the trouble to make a violin as perfect as human hands can make it, just to have somebody play a half a dozen tunes on it and then say, now give it back to me, I want to smash it against the workbench? Why, that doesn't make sense. While I said, I say it reverently, it doesn't make sense to think that God would go to all the trouble to create your personality and mine with all of its possibilities of love and faith and hope just to have us play a few inconclusive years and then to take us back and gleefully smash us forever against the workbench of the universe. No, he's not that kind of a God. I said, son, I believe this is the tuning up stage. And he wants us to get in tune with his will through faith in Christ so one day he can fit us into the symphony of eternity. And the boy said, but suppose you're wrong. Well, I said, I know one thing. I'd rather be wrong that way because I know my life will be nobler and happier living on the basis there is more to come. I'd rather be wrong that way, if I am wrong, than to live as if there were no God and then to find out I was wrong. That would be a mistake. But I said, son, I haven't given you my real reason yet. The real reason I believe, if you didn't come back in the flesh, that wouldn't be the end of you, is that I believe you simply cannot explain the Christian church apart from the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Understand it? How can you? But it wasn't his teachings, it wasn't his influence, as powerful as those were in the life of the disciples that sent them out to die for their faith. It was the resurrected Christ. They didn't go out to say, we thought up a doctrine of immortality, and so we want to use a story of a resurrection to illustrate it. They went out and said, we experienced his resurrection. He was alive again. And they tried to interpret it. And so I believe God is love, and the love operates in a moral universe. And that in that moral universe, where we do get divided by our sin and our ignorance, Christ is God's bridge by which we come back to a restored fellowship with him. And it's important, because one day we will lay down this physical body, but the spirit will not die. I've got to have a fifth stake in here somewhere. I believe the church is indispensable. That when one becomes a Christian, he wants to become a part of the body of Jesus Christ, a living cell in the body of Christ, so that he can help this body to function in the world today the way Jesus functioned when he was alive on earth. I think one of the reasons Christ wants us to become a part of his church is so that we can be strengthened. No one is strong enough to live the Christian life as he ought to live it all alone. We need the contagion of each other's enthusiasm and faith to make our own faith the stronger. And no one can do what Jesus wants done in the world alone. We have to do it together. We had the boys' choir from Princeton at our church. I guess the oldest boy in the choir is about 13. We have a platform just about, it's higher than this. And our piano, a baby grand, was down on the floor level. And the head of the choir said, would you mind if we moved the piano up on the platform? No, I said, I wouldn't mind, but you're going to have to wait now because all the janitors have gone home. There are no men around except you, and I'm here, but we're not going to move that piano together. So we'll just wait until some of the men. Oh, he said, if we're allowed to move it, we'll move it. I said, who will move it? He said, we will. I said, those boys? Well, he said, don't look so surprised. We've done it before. If I hadn't seen it, I wouldn't have believed it. They got around the piano like ants around a piece of sugar. Now, one couldn't have done it, and 10 couldn't have done it. I don't know how many there were, but they were around there. And when he gave the signal, those boys lifted that piano and walked it over to the platform. They did together what none of them could have done alone. Sometimes I think as Baptists we don't make enough of the church. I was talking to some Episcopalians, and I was giving them an illustration of how pastoral work goes along with preaching. I said, for instance, there is a woman in my church who discounts some of my preaching because I once failed her as a pastor. On the other hand, I quoted Lawson Cook when he was the head of the Brotherhood in the Southern Convention, who said that his son was very, very ill, and his pastor came and spent all night in prayerful vigil with him. He said, after that night, my pastor never could preach a poor sermon. In other words, he never could have it in his heart to criticize anything his pastor said after that night of pastoral vigilance. And I thought I'd made a wonderful point when one of these Episcopalian rectors spoke up and said, that's just the trouble with you Baptists. I said, trouble? He said, yes, trouble. You make the whole thing depend so much on the performance of the minister that you end up with a personality cult. He said, we make some mistakes, but not that one. We make the church so important that their loyalty is to the church, not to any minister. Well, I think he had a point. He didn't invalidate anything that I'd said. But I do think sometimes we need to help our people see the importance of becoming a part of this living fellowship of Jesus Christ. Now, I haven't told you everything I believe. I tried to tell you some of the things that I think will hold me steady when the storms of life beat against my soul. And I believe they'll hold you steady. And I hope you share them with me. And if you do, I know you'll want to be a part of the fellowship right here where you can serve him better. And if you aren't a part of a fellowship in this area, if you'd never really taken your stand for Jesus Christ and said yes to him, now's the time to do it. There may be someone here tonight who would like to say, I want to profess him before men. Maybe every one of you has professed him, but maybe someone would like to say, either by transfer of letter or statement of experience or coming into the associate membership of the church, I'd like to take my stand shoulder to shoulder with the other Christians of this community so that everybody will know I'm four square for Jesus Christ. If so, will you come? Well, we sing 325.